Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Sarah Tyson, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Colorado Denver. I'm co-host of the channel along with Carrie Figdor, Robert Talese, and Malcolm Keating. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Emily S. Lee, Professor of Philosophy at California State University, Fullerton. Her book, A Phenomenology for Women of Color, Merleau-Ponty and Identity and Difference, is just out from Lexington Books. How can we understand the changing power of race and gender to shape our reality? How shared is reality? Can narratives of experience help us develop these analyses? What role does embodiment play in shaping experience? In A Phenomenology of Women of Color, Lee uses the tools of critical phenomenology to deeply engage with the theoretical work of women of color to approach these questions. Through reconstructing phenomenological approaches, particularly as developed by Maurice Merleau-Ponty, Lee helps us see past naturalization of the identity group, women of color, to understand more deeply the coalitional struggle its articulation involves.
Emily S. Lee, welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Will you tell us a bit about yourself and your background as a philosopher, how you came to write this book, how your interests brought you to phenomenology?
So I first was introduced to philosophy as a Lincoln Douglas debater, actually, in high school. And the only reason I even tried out for debate was because in junior high school, someone placed me immediately in a math team and didn't even offer the suggestion of a debate team. And I think something in me, once I started high school, just felt like, what's going on in this tracking and what is debate about? So because of that, I tried out for the debate team and it turned out I was actually pretty good at it. And if anything, I was more interested in it than the math team, because I didn't do anything with math after that. So, but it was Lincoln Douglas debate, for people who know about it. It actually utilizes a lot of philosophical arguments. It was in high school. I read John Rawls's A Theory of Justice, Locke's Second Treatise on Civil Government, Plato's Republic, Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra. I'm sure I didn't understand most of it, but nevertheless, that's where I was introduced to philosophical ideas. And so I ended up not majoring it in college. I think it was just 18-year-old hubris. I was sitting in a class and they were reading all the texts that I felt like I already read. So I skipped it. But thankfully, I did do an undergraduate thesis with my economics advisor. And he realized the questions I was interested in were really philosophical. So he was like, forget an MBA, you really should go into philosophy instead. And I guess in the end, he gave me a lot of good arguments about it too. And I think in the end, he was persuasive. So that's how I got into philosophy. I was introduced to Merleau-Ponty's work. The first time I was introduced to his work, I really didn't like it. Like, it was the article I in mind. I felt like the language was just so obtuse and circular and unnecessarily vague. And so I wasn't turned on by him at all. But I think I ended up reading The Phenomenology of Perception, which is I think one of his central books. And at the same time, I was reading Patricia Williams's book, The Alchemy of Race and Rights. And I just felt like the two works really spoke to each other. And I think that's when this whole project got started. Like, so not just this project, but several of my articles center around this project, because what I liked about Patricia Williams, she was talking about all these experiences she had where, like, her understanding of what just occurred was completely different from the majority understanding, right? Or the social understanding. And I think growing up, I always felt that disconnect of some of my personal experiences, and I would share experiences with other people, but then both of us would leave with very different understandings of that experience. So I think that's why the Williams book really spoke to me, and the way that Merleau-Ponty's work delves into experience, right? Just that I ended up with, I think, with this project, right? So yeah. I guess I should say why I mean I don't you know, a colleague of mine says that most philosophers really do work on questions that motivate themselves, and hence I guess my interest in the lives of women of color might be evident, right? But I do think the first time I got introduced to the term woman of color, I think someone from my alma mater was asking if they could call me that. So that must have been in the mid-1990s, which means that the term isn't that new, right? It isn't that old. It's pretty new, if anything. And I've been thinking about the term. I mean, because for a while I've already been. You know, it went from being identified as Korean American to Asian American to woman of color. Like, so it was a development even in recognizing my own identity. And I think Chandra Mohanty and Pooram Jung both write about, because they're both immigrants, and they both talk about becoming an Asian American woman, right? Recognizing that they're American as well as Asian, right? So I think in that way, the term woman of color has developed and grown, and to and the way that I use the term, I know the term has faced some contestations, and as I think especially in the international context, women from other worlds don't other countries do not necessarily embrace the term. They think of it as an American or a Western dominated term, that it may be hegemonic in the sense. But I do know that some of the women, at least I think the Santa Cruz Women's Collective, use the term in an aspirational sense, evoking a future community. I think they mean it in a they use it for coalitional building senses. So I think that's the sense that I would like to use the term, right? I mean, acknowledging that I guess a lot of these terms do not necessarily have clean beginnings, but perhaps in a future sense that in an aspirational sense, I guess, for coalition building purposes, I guess I wanted to explore the term, I guess.
Yeah, it really is. It's clearly a driving question of the book, right? What can this term, what can we do with it? How can it be creatively used? And then phenomenology becomes the method by which you approach this. And so I want to delve into the tools that Merleau-Ponty gives us. And particularly one place you start is how phenomenology's conception of perception is inherently active. Helps us to think about bias more holistically. And I have to admit, I was surprised you went to bias. And so will you talk about bias? Will you talk about how active perception's inherent activeness helps us to think about bias? And then I want to get into multiplicitous subjects and sort of advantages you see them having using Mariana Ortega's concept of multiplicitous subjects and how that helps us with bias, or what the advantages of having multiple horizons.
In the current work, there's a recent trend in philosophy about theorizing racism as bias, right? And to me, this isn't too novel, partly because I think for philosophers of race, we recognize, one, that race is socially constructed, and then the initial Understandings of race has isolated as individual prejudice. And I think bias fits it along that language of individual prejudice. But what bias, the current understanding or the current emphasis on racism as bias acknowledges the social embeddedness of bias and that our society and our culture sort of plant in us certain kinds of biases. The literature here gets interesting because, especially between the debate between Jennifer Saw and Julie's Holroyd, I think there's some question of responsibility of bias if bias is socially embedded. I think Saw gives up any responsibility by placing it on society. But Julie Holroyd at least it recognizes, look, not everybody in a society holds the same biases. And so she does talk about long-term held biases and how we are held responsible for some of our biases this way, right? So, and that biases do change within society. So, I mean, that discussion is interesting, but I guess what for me, having read all this phenomenology and recognizing that phenomenology, first and foremost, it talks about the definition I like about phenomenology, I think the most accessible one, is to define a layer of living experience. So phenomenology tries to clear out the field of about claims about what can we know or not know. I think there's either phenomenologists will argue from Edmund Husserl on, I think will argue that too much of philosophy has made claims about what they know that are already kind of too laden with consciousness or too dependent upon actually seeing material things in the world, like empiricism and whatnot. But I think phenomenology wanted to get right. Are we projecting? Are we presuming that the world can be seen like it in its naked sense or not? For phenomenologists, they argue that our experience of the world is always a mesh up between objective material things in the world and subjective consciousness meaning, and that we can't disentangle these two features of the world. And I think phenomenologists will say philosophers like Descartes overemphasize the consciousness meanings of the world, and empiricists overemphasize the material features of the world, whereas phenomenologists will say that all our experience is always some combination of the two, and we don't quite know the combination of the two. I think what this does is to say is to define subject. The easiest ways to define phenomena then becomes a subject-object bipolarity, and I think once we recognize that, then phenomenology's understanding of perception would imply that. That perception occurs. There's no such thing as pure perception. Perception is always influenced by the intentions of the subject, as well as the social meanings in the world that we enter and occupy. So because of this, because perception is never perfectly clear of just things in the world, it's perception hides in two senses. So their perception is always going to be incomplete, even though it feels complete. And I guess the example I always like to use is just a glass of milk. Oh no, that one doesn't work. The second way that perception hides is that it highlights what the subject is already familiar with, I think. And then the third feature of this would be our own embodiment, our own place in the world, influences the incomplete, impacts even further the incompleteness and the highlighting of that which we are already familiar. So understanding these features of perception gives us an understanding of perception that's active. But I think what that also says is that perception in itself is already unavoidably biased. So I think knowing these features about the phenomenological understanding of perception made me look at the current analysis and on understanding racism as bias as sort of like that the analysis and bias does nothing in a way. Of course, perception is biased becomes my so I guess my this is why I just wanted to bring the two together to say that look, I think that this current understanding this project of just trying to understand racism as bias is unavoidable, considering human perception as always occurring in the world, always enmeshed with both the meanings in the world as well as the materiality and the physical empirical features of the world, right? So that's why I guess I just wanted to at least bring these two together. One, I did want to address a current reading of race and racism analysis, but and then two, just sort of show that look, if we phenomenologists have already known there's biases in perception, so I think this analysis goes absolutely does not, further the analysis of race, of understanding functionings of race. So I think so to this debate, to this discussion, what I thought we can do is when we bring in Mariana Ortega's understanding of multiplicitous subjects with at least two identifying features, race or sex, but I think she talks about others as well, right? That what this does is actually complicate even further philosophy's current understanding of racism as bias, right? So she actually says that for Ortega says she talks about a multiplicitous subject, someone who has some sense of unifying and core identity, but also all these different identifying features. And I think what I wanted to suggest is that because multiplicitous subjects occupy more than one world because of their different identifying features, they may have different biases than just the dominant society's biases. So, and I think that perhaps adding and considering multiplicitous subjects to philosophy of races, current understanding of racism as bias. I thought that maybe there then we could really deal with the different biases of multiplicitous subjects. Ultimately, I want to argue that it might be the case that multiplicitous subjects are poised to recognize more of the biases, I think, within society. This is not to say that multiple subjects don't have biases, but that in occupying more than one world, they may be able to see the biases more. So I hope that was clear. I think that yes.
Yeah, no, it makes me think of, for instance, in Gloria Anzaldúa's work when she talks about sort of confronting different things from different perspective from different worlds she's coming from and having to sort of right confront the biases of one world as representing another world and a world she comes from, right? And that sort of no, I found that the way you brought together bias and perception there really exciting, and it really sets up where you go next in the project about experience, because you point out that Merleau-Ponty's philosophy is really about experience. That's really central to what's driving his phenomenological work. So you do a lot of work to reconstruct what he's doing, to talk about how his phenomenology can help us think through the epistemic value of experience. And already you're setting it up with the questions of bias and perception, and then moving into these questions of experience. But how does Merleau-Ponty's phenomenology help us with these really like pressing debates about the epistemic value of experience?
I think that I felt the urge to salvage experience as epistemically valuable, because philosophy had been having this debate about whether experience has epistemic value. Right? There's been, I think, the Hegelian school has it isn't just experience for the Hegelian. It is one's position in society, one's situation in society has epistemic makes an epistemic difference, right? And the Hegelian school, continuing to Marx and then to feminist standpoint theory. But I think it's especially when I started reading some of the debates about does experience have epistemic value, when experience itself may simply reflect existing socially constructed meanings about the experience, right? So, but I think that I knew that like autobiographical narratives and feminist movements that depended on, like now that depended on women referring to their experiences, that and then the autobiographical slave narratives, especially, and or they relied upon accounts of their experience to challenge existing meanings and about what is subjectivity, what is a meaningful life, that there are other people besides the what's dominantly reflected in society, right? So I think that prioritizing women of color, especially, I really did feel the urgency to salvage experience as a source of knowledge to at least maintain this, right? So, and again, I think here, so I think the structure of the book, the first chapter is on perception, the second is on experience, and the third is on embodiment. And ultimately, I make the argument that these are the three phenomenal, that these three are phenomena, that and hence why the phenomenology, that these three features, perception, experience, and embodiment, are phenomena in that the material conditions and the meanings about these, the narratives and the meanings that are about them, cannot be separated, right? So acknowledging that I wanted to salvage the epistemic value of experience, but also knowing that experience itself is complicated because there's no such thing as a pure naked experience that just gives us meaning, but that every experience is already laden with meaning, and how does a subject actually disentangle a meaning from this, right? So can it really provide, I don't know, meaning, truth, because of this, right? So so again, this is why I think I turned to phenomenology, because again, for phenomenology, and especially for Merleau-Ponty, he describes phenomena as a layer of living experience, right, through which other people and things are first given to us, right? So they don't reduce experience down to a thing or an essence. It's not just purely objective or subjective. And instead, for Merleau-Ponty, his understanding of experience, as I read him, is it's always an intermeshed conglomerate between the subject, the world, in time, right? And I think what I did was try to trace out that if experience is never a thing-like, right? And then instead, it's always in relation between these three things. I wanted to articulate the distances between these to sort of explain why it is that experience has epistemic value, but people may draw different meanings from it, right? So I traced out at least three distances within the heart of the structure of experience. And that is one between the subject and the world, including other subjects, and then two between undergoing the experience and reflecting upon the experience, meaning that sometimes one goes through the experience and then only after thinking about the experience does then one kind of sort of understand the experience. And then this is an ongoing process too, because one may have just immediately gone through the experience and understand it. And then like 5 years later in our life, we may be, oh, you know what, that was really more about this, right? So there's a lot of distance in there between actually going through the experience and then reflecting upon the experience, right? And then the third one I talked about is between language and the experience itself, because even language is not fully formed, and language doesn't fully convey the experience, but nevertheless, we rely upon language. And I think language can be more than our experience when we think about poetry and fiction and whatnot. So on the one hand, there isn't a clean representation directly from experience via language. I mean, the language both inhibits our understanding of our experience as well as goes beyond our understanding of experience. Of the experience. So I think that there are distances in the structure of experience. So I wanted to better understand this phenomenal structure of experience, and by trying to articulate these distances, what I wanted to do was to one still insists you can't bypass experience. Experience still is a source of knowledge, but I think I also wanted to admit that there can be still some contestations, debates about how to understand the experience. And I think that happens even within one person. When I mentioned about the temporality of going through an experience and then having one understanding 10 minutes later and having another understanding 5 years later, right? In this sort of way. I wanted to definitely salvage that. Nevertheless, we can't bypass the experience itself. So,
well, it's striking what a core motivation it was for the book. What it sounds like you had these experiences of going through something and seeing it so differently from somebody else who'd had,
yeah,
quote unquote, the same experience.
Yes.
Right. And so what you're, yeah, saying, the distances that might make one's experience more similar or more different from somebody else.
Yeah. Right.
And so it makes sense, right? Like the core experience of, but we just had two totally different experiences of that,
yeah,
and we're telling a very different, and that in comparing notes, right, your interpretation might come closer together or move even further apart.
Yes,
through that practice,
yeah,
of mutual reflection and putting into language what happened.
Yes, right, yeah, especially putting into language too, right? And then there we could both see how we understood it differently, and as well as have the possibility of coming to some sort of agreement about it, right, too.
As well as turning up how different positions vis-a-vis the experience could have resulted in really different understandings of the meaning of it.
Yes, right, yeah. So I think that, I mean, experience can't be used like in a sort of flat sense of like, okay, I had this experience, it means this, right?
Right.
It is a more complicated, because experience isn't just an object, right? It isn't just a thing in the world that can just be easily seen, right? Just to kind of see the structure of experience, yeah.
Yeah, and so you take part, one direction you take this phenomenological understanding of experience is as a resource for heterogeneous commonality, for so this intersectional approach to identity and understanding how people can be quite different and also work in solidarity, come to have agreements about both what's happened and what ought to happen. So will you talk about how that these this phenomenological understanding of experience becomes a resource for heterogeneous commonality?
Thank you. I wanted to address, especially because I'm addressing women of color here, I wanted to address the term intersectionality. I totally appreciate Mariana Ortega's introduction of the phrase multiplicitous subjects, but before that phrase, women of color have been grappling with this term intersectionality for a long time. There are criticisms of the, it's been attributed to Crenshaw, and there are criticisms of the term intersectionality, whether it treats race and sex as having developed completely separately or not. But I think the development I appreciated was Patricia Hill Collins's engagement with this term, and that, and it's her who suggests that we anchor the term intersectionality down to with standpoint theory. And the reason she suggests this is she wonders if the term intersectionality is better for describing individual experiences, but not group experiences. So she's trying to move to more than just individual experiences of different individual experiences, but to theorize group experiences. And so I appreciate that move for her. And so she thinks that intersectionality may not be the best for group experiences unless we anchor it to standpoint theory. I know that she's mainly concerned with essentialism and recognizing that women with intersectional identities are not all the same. That they may actually have different experiences too, and have come to draw different conclusions. So, but I think her concern with essentialism applies for any group identity, not just such a complicated group identity. But I appreciate still where she's going with this by trying to anchor intersectionality down with standpoint theory. And I loved this idea of heterogeneous commonality because what I liked is that she what she well this one I want to give to Anna Katastathis. She explains that what Collins is doing is recognizing the internal heterogeneity among women with intersectional identities. And that's the, and that I really appreciated because especially in thinking about women of color, this is a very diverse identity group to even put together, right? So, I mean, it means African American woman, Asian American woman, Latin American woman, Native American. I mean, South Pacific Islander woman. So, especially to name something like intersectional or women of color or multiplicitous, I think to recognize it as a group identity, first and foremost, is to recognize that there is already internal heterogeneity, right? And what Katastasis does nicely with this is to point out, look, just the fact that there is already an internal heterogeneity and that we're still to the extent that we can identify ourselves as a group identity implies that the internal heterogeneity actually helps us to recognize an external homogeneity, right? So, and I think that this isn't just true for this complex identity, this intersectional identity. I think even for single axis identity groups, like just I think I was toying with the idea of just black men or just white women. Like you might think of that as just a single axis, but actually within black men, there are so many differences there too. There is heterogeneity internal to that identity group, and there is heterogeneity internal to the identity group of white women. So I think this question of recognizing the internal heterogeneity of a group identity is a feature anytime we try to talk about group identities, right? And so I appreciated the heterogeneous commonality idea to recognize that as it is, even within one group identity, in order to recognize the group identity, we actually hold this fine balance of recognizing how we are still a homogeneous as well as heterogeneous internal to the identity group, right? I think, and so, but here I think I want to look at the internal heterogeneity within the identity group, women of color, as a resource instead of not only as a challenge to forming the identity group, but also as a resource for the identity group to actually recognize its external homogeneity, right? So, I the way that I wanted to think about this again is to draw the idea again that if women of color occupy more than one world, the dominant world, as well as other smaller smaller worlds within or overlapping with the dominant world, I guess I wanted to suggest that their experience of the world is denser because of the overlapping. And that such density and opacity and thickness are not just sources of weakness to break the identity group apart, but are also sources of strength to recognize commonalities for recognizing a homogeneity for the group as a whole. Yeah, I think that. I don't know.
I'm wondering if there's something analogous here with how experience itself with it for one person is heterogeneous, and so there's meaning making has to happen across those one's own multiple interpretations of experience, and the self-reflective work of trying to understand oneself as capable of multiple understandings of an experience that. Even for folks who are similarly positioned in a world, right, that they're going to have differences in their experiences about what's happened, even if you're in the same quote unquote experience together, that you might be similarly positioned vis-a-vis the experience. The social world might be putting you in a similar category or something like this, but there's still going to be differences in that experience
Internally,
that have to
yeah.
be made meaning of, right? And that if we're
Yeah.
aware of that, the necessity of doing that work of making meaning together, then that, as you said, it becomes then not just a site of possible division, but a site of work to come together to find commonality through the
Yes.
heterogeneity.
Yes, absolutely. So that's what I'm trying to think about, because it made me think when I think about overlapping of worlds, that's where I started thinking of that these differences are not simply something that separates us, but that actually these incongruent experiences sort of overlaps on top of each other, so that we are actually as a group identity given the opportunity to think these things through, to start seeing that some of the commonalities to keep the identity group together, especially for because of the importance of, I think, coalition building and actually starting to change some of the dominant meanings in the world. in this way, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and especially in the face of what, and we'll get this concept in a minute, we'll talk about it more, but in the face of indifference, right? In a world that's going to meet folks with indifference, and the indifference might operate really differently depending on how people are positioned in the world, but that
Yeah.
the indifference is deadly. And so building
Yes.
coalition in the face of indifference, even though it
Yes.
may be operating differently.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so part of what you help us understand or you give us is this historical racial sexual schema, which is a development of building on Fanon's historical racial schema. You start to build up
Yes.
this notion of a historical racial sexual schema to think about embodiment, right? To think about how people that embodiment doesn't just come out of nowhere, right? Like that practice, habits of the body are formed through the world into which we're born and live. Yeah, so will you talk about the historical racial sexual schema, how that helps us understand the embodiment of women of color? And then I want to talk about motivation and sedimentation
Oh
and
my goodness,
all these wonderful
yeah.
things that you give us because you're giving us such a powerful way of thinking about embodiment.
Yeah, so yeah, so I mean, this is the main reason too. I guess not that Merleau-Ponty is the first philosopher accredited for really trying to explore embodiment. And I think the term embodiment itself, the term embodiment to replace the body itself is already a move because when we refer to our bodies as the body, we just think of it as a material physical thing, right? Whereas as soon as we talk about subjects as embodied, we're recognizing that our body is already an intermeshed experience between both the mind and the material structure of our body, right? So Merleau-Ponty picked this up from by marrying Husserl and Heidegger's work with Gestalt theorist, and he uses two from Gestalt theorists. He borrowed two concepts about how to rethink the body, not as a material, only as a material thing. And so he had introduced the term body image and body schema. I think that body image is pretty more well known in our society, but body schema is the one that talks more about the body's spatiality and temporality in the world and the body's sensory motor capacities that function without awareness. Like we don't actually have to look at our body to go move my hand this way, right? Like we know how to do it in itself, right? So what's Frantz Fanon did was he understood the importance of this work for philosophy of race and for talking about the embodied differences of race. And for Fanon, what he highlights is that the Black body is so hyper visible in our society. And I think this is why our society has so much colorism. And the colorism isn't, just among white populations, it's internalized into populations of color, right? So people of color. So he said that this hyper visual experience of one's embodiment has grown a historical racial schema underneath the body schema of white folks, right? So the Black subject, in addition to having a body image and a body schema, also develops a historical racial schema, is where the Black subject's experience of their body in space and in time is also embedded with hyper awareness of Black history and the color of their skin, right? What I suggest in chapter three of the book is that if this is the case, then for a woman of color, they must develop another kind of schema under that where. And I think feminist philosophy has talked a great deal about the the visibility of women's bodies, right? And the way in which visibility is used against women, for women, and the way women use the visibility of their bodies as well, right? In the way that we're taught to be so self-conscious of what do we look like as women, right? So I guess I wanted to couple in these ideas to say, so if this is the case that hypervisibility constructs a historical racial schema, then for women of color, there is a possibility that we are developing a historical racial sexual schema in the experience of our own embodiment, right? And what I want to do here, though, is I didn't want to talk about this in just, I think Fanon talks about it in a very negative sense, that the historical racial schema, for him, it's because it's produced by the look of whites upon his body and all the meanings that white people have about Black bodies, right? But I guess I wanted to point out that the historical racial sexual schema, I wanted to point out the possibility that it's that women of color are not just looked upon by white men, but that women of color are looking at each other too, right? That because the women of color identity group, because there are other women of color, and then there are also other white women, and there are also Black men, that there are other people looking at the women of color's embodiment, that I think the development of the historical racial sexual schema is not going to be a purely negative, I'm not this, I'm not this, I'm not this, but also I'm hoping that there are some supportive features about the historical racial sexual schema for women of color. So I wanna posit the possibility of the historical racial, developing a historical racial sexual schema for women of color, but I do want to separate from Fanon in that I do wanna give more power to the look of other women of color onto women of color in helping develop the historical racial sexual schema so that it isn't purely, I think, negative is what I wanted to do on this one. Yeah, I think, go ahead. Yes, please.
Oh, no, sorry. Well, I wanted to picking up on that, mm-hmm. because you very much have notions of creativity.
Yes.
Within horizons. And
yes.
But I think you give us this concept of motivation that's so important, because you don't make it sound like people can just transcend what's happened or their horizon, but that this creativity that's possible through the concept of motivation. So I want to invite you to talk more about that.
Yeah. So one of my one of the things that I when I noticed this concept of motivations, I was looking for the body image. I know that there was a priority on body movement, that body in movement itself, body motility. Merleau-Ponty was arguing that body motility had its own intentionality. So intentionality isn't just from the mind or from consciousness, but that our body already has an intentionality. And Sean Gallagher's work on this actually proves this to be the case, that quite a lot of it of our body movements don't begin in the mind that tell our bodies what to do. If anything, some of the movement comes from our body, and then eventually we tell the mind that, oh, we're doing this.
Yeah, so, here's why.
Exactly. But the body already has momentum and has intentionality, right? And so the question is, what initiates that that movement, that what I ended up if the body was just a thing, then it would be just physical causes, like bumping into something else, right? But the body isn't just a thing. And if the body was purely an instrument of the mind, then only the mind is the one who initiates movement of the body. And we've already seen that that's not the case either, right? And I always like to joke that this is especially the case in terms of like some of us would love to run a mile in a certain period of time, but you know, not without a lot of conditioning, right? The body resists that, right? So knowing these features, the question of what is the cause of body motility motivated me. And that's when I noticed this idea of motivation. And so instead of causality, Merleau-Ponty moves on to an indirect causality or motivation. And he was inspired with this notion from Freud's work, where Freud, you know, most people joke about how he attributes sexuality to be the motivator for everything and anything, right? But on the one hand, it's, you know, it's funny, but on the other hand, what Freud did try to locate is or identify is an indirect causality of which the expressions are not clear, are not direct, are not the same for every single individual, right? The expressions of our sexuality are not the same for every single individual. So in this sort of sense, what Merleau-Ponty says is that body movement may have be caused by motivations. That, and I think in the book I list several like time or pregnancy, horizon. I'm trying to remember the others, but autochthonous meaning or something. But he locates other sources of motivations for body movement. I do want to say that I think the one that most people usually refer to is body habits. And I want to acknowledge habits as a motivation too, but that motivate, but my question has been, well, where did the development of such a habit come from? And the question further for me is how does one change habits? Because we can develop habits that are good as well as habits that are bad. And so where does the motivator for changing body ha movement habits come from as well? And so that's where I wanted to forward the notion of motivations, because again, it's ambiguous, right? It's not clear that every motivation will be expressed the same way for every single person. There are different motivations from the world, depending on your horizon, depending on the time in your life, depending on other people in your world, right? There are already other motivations that influence people in different ways. And I think I wanted to recognize the ambiguity and the openness in these motivations, but I also wanted to suggest that the openness is both a source of unpredictability of how people move their bodies, but I think it's also a source of creativity and possibility that eventually women of color's body movements may vary and forward different ways of moving in the world, and hence different meanings about their embodiment. Because I think ultimately what I wanted to be clear about is I think there's enough analysis explaining all the socially motivated, socially constructed forces asking us to move our bodies a certain way, like that woman should be standing like this, a woman should be sitting like this, or a woman should be dressed this way. There are all these sort of socially constructed forces and influences on encouraging us to move our bodies a certain way. But I guess I wanted to say that the body is not simple, our embodiment is not simply worked upon, but that we ourselves can, with our body movement, push back onto and change and influence and add meaning into the world, right? Because I guess I want to centrally position the body as and body movement as the source for this, and not simply consciousness, right? Because as a phenomenologist, I don't want to prioritize consciousness because that would make me a Cartesian instead, right? So I wanted to put the force of the possibility of of changing some of the existing meanings in the world on body movement, I think.
Well, and part of the urgency of this, part of what its power is, I think, is because of what you talk about in the last chapter, which is in the face of indifference. And as I mentioned earlier, the deadliness of indifference and the sort of society that sets groups up to say, like, the problem's internal to you, what's happening to you is about your group, and society's fine. So will you talk more about thinking about how phenomenology helps us think about embodied difference to push back on indifference?
I mean that this I feel like sometimes like racism isn't just about sort of actively doing something to someone. I think it's about not doing and not caring about other groups, right? I think that, and if anything, I think that one's the far too easy way that we all have of maintaining systems of racism and structural racism, right? If we're moving past understanding racism as just individual, but that it is social and it's structural, right? I think this sort of passivity and indifference is really the ways in which racism persists, right? Like racist meanings persist in our society. So I did want to come out and talk about this, right? And there, I mean, I think ultimately what I wanted to, I suggest this structure. I don't know if this is idealistic of me, but I proposed an ontological structure. Identity indifference to help us insist that we're always connected with other people and that our fate is always tied to other people, right? So on the one hand, I want to always respect that difference makes a difference, right? But I think I do take seriously that if we regard others as just so different, then I think we might fall into indifference about them, right? So this is why I think I think idealistically or not, I thought that a philosophical ontological concept of identity indifference may help us to better recognize that we are always tied to the other. And I think the phenomenal structure is ideal for recognizing that there isn't an atomistic or an essentialistic experience of the world, but that we are always tied together, right? So I think chapter five of this book does I kind of historically go through that this some understanding of our relation with the other has always sort of existed in philosophical thinking, right? In our old metaphysical debates about monism and dualism and essentialism and pluralism and essence and accidents. And but I think Merleau-Ponty was pondering this. These were just in the footnotes of his last book, The Visible and the Invisible, where he insists that this relation between identity and difference is immediate and it's not just temporal. I think because Aristotle and Hegel were the ones who did establish a relationship between monism and pluralism, and but it was a temporal based relationship. For Merleau-Ponty, he wants to say that there is an immediate relation between identity and difference. And so I'm suggesting this metaphysical structure of identity and difference. And I do trace out like some structures of identity and difference, but I think ultimately in terms of perception, in terms of our relationship with others, in terms of ourselves and time, that our own life is an identity and difference, right? There's one unifying thread, but we really are not the same person as we were when we were children, or when what we're going to be when we're older, right? I trace out at least four different ways to think about identity and difference, and but ultimately to argue that we are always in relation with other people, and hence to not and to, and hence to discourage considering other groups of people as people we should not care about, right? And I especially am concerned about I think Glenn Laurie says this is racial stigma when we know an appalling statistic about another group, and it instills no consideration for action for us because we just think it's a statistic about them, not about us, right? So I think the one that did get some press about was considering the number of Black men in prison, right? Or the one that that really struck me was that we knew all along that communities of color had domestic violence concerns, but it inspired no action from the state at all until the feminist movement said, "Oh, white women experience domestic violence too." Then legislation was passed, and so that meant that all these women experiencing domestic violence was not worth consideration, right? So, and for me recently, the statistic that I've been working with is I didn't know this until was the number of Asian American women who commit suicide. It's actually a really, really high number, one of the highest, and I think if not the highest among women. And instead of considering this a concern, it's sort of explained away as a cultural phenomenon, which to me is just very essentializing. So I think these are signs of an indifference to a population group to say that's their problem, not my problem. And this is how Glenn Laurie defines racial stigmatization, right? So I think that trying to think about trying to defray this indifference by emphasizing that there is always going to be a unifying relationship between other communities and our community was the motivation for this chapter. I'm not sure if it was successful. I to turn to a metaphysical concept to talk about a social political, but I think that's where I was. It's okay.
Yeah, well, you get the argument there, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, what are you working on now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm so relieved this one's done. I will tell you that, right?
Congratulations. Yeah.
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 I've been I've got at least over this summer, I've got at least two projects I'm trying to finish off. I've got one article. I'm actually trying to turn more to my epistemic projects instead. I think the article that has been most cited among my work is a Hypatia article on epistemology, actually, and on it's now I forget the title of the, but I think it's the epistemology of the question of authenticity, I think. And I've been wanting to follow up on that because it's been the so well received, but also because I had other questions about it. And one of them was I've been exploring Helen Longino's work because she, I think, gives one of the best systematic reasons for why diversity and difference is epistemically valuable within philosophy of science. And so I guess I wanted to trace that out because I guess I want to argue for the value of diversity and difference, especially in this current, period
Yeah.
where there have been so many attacks on critical philosophy, critical race theory, on DIE, right? DEI. So I guess I wanted to say, look, diversity is epistemically important to get even scientific knowledge, right? So maybe we should respect diversity more than you think, right? So that article, I'm going to try to finish that out, and then I've been working on an article on intra-minority. What was it called? I guess I wanted to on anti-Asian hate crimes and intra-minority conflict that, because I guess I was concerned about, this is a follow-up on a blog, on the blog piece on the APA blog about the during COVID, and there had the anti-Asian hate crimes, and apparently 25% of it is committed by other minority groups. So I'm working on a piece trying to think that through, actually. And that, but so I'm hoping to collect these more epistemic pieces together, on epistemology and agency, really together, to another book. So
Awesome.
let's see how that goes.
Yeah. Excited to read it.
Okay. Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, Emily S. Lee, thank you so much for being on New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you.